Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. You have no idea how glad I am to be here today. I just want to share that with y'all. So we're going to have a great conversation today. We're talking about the space between space. Are you ready for this conversation? I want you to open up your mind, and I want you to just, if you can, spend some time with me here this afternoon for at least an hour, just to have an oasis in your day, to have a mentally stimulating conversation. So if you look around in nature, the basis of nature is cooperation, is it not? I mean, it's in the if you look at a flock of birds, a school of fish, cohesion is happening all over the place. So then why is it human nature to be separate or to compete or to be competitive? This is the question that Lynn McTaggart has been asking. Now, Lynn is a wonderful author. She's a best-selling author of the book called The Intention Experiment. And she's really a cutting-edge author on the forefront of frontier science. I love that term, frontier science. Welcome to the show, Lynn. Thanks for joining me again.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. Are you here in the States right now? Because I know Lynn usually resides in London, England, yes?
Yes, I'm here. I'm in Seattle at the moment.
Very good.
And I'm doing a tour of the Northwest.
Yeah, I noticed that of the book. The new book that Lynn has out is called The Bond, Connecting Through the Space Between Us. Connecting Through the Space Between Us. That's what we're going to be talking about. So based on the way that I talked and I opened the show there, what instinct that nature has to be together, to bond together, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really wanted to find out was how come we're in such a mess right now?
Mm.
You know, we hear from every quarter that it's the end of something. You know, it's the end of capitalism as we know it. It's the end of oil. It's the end of food because it's the end of oil. And, you know, if you believe in the Mayan calendar, it's even the end of the world.
Right, right.
So everybody's thinking about this. And I wanted to look at some basics and just see, were we made to connect, or were we made to compete? That was really my question.
What a great question.
How has nature designed us? So, you know, our scientific story, which has defined us for 300 plus years, basically paints us as a load of separate things in competition for survival. That's pretty much the scientific story we've been told, and that's the way we live our lives. But to be honest, after doing a lot of research in physics and biology and psychology and sociology, I came to the opposite conclusion. I came to the conclusion that there is a bond between subatomic particles, between our bodies and the environment, between ourselves and everyone with whom we come into contact. In all of our societal structures, there is a connection underpinning it so profound that it's impossible to say where one thing ends and another thing begins.
Okay, so let's dive into that a little bit. And it's a great concept, and I want you to just kind of take it piece by piece. So we look at nature all around us, and its tendency is to bond together. Yet human nature, we hear a lot about, you know, in society about survival of the fittest, the competition within businesses to be better than the other, we're number one, those types of things. Ingrained in our society, we're constantly comparing ourselves to each other, at least the media is. And, you know, I read the beginning, the story that you wrote at the beginning of the book about your daughter and how she got edged out of a part in a play because of another competitive type of female and teenager. Our children, I mean, even my daughter at 8 years old, is having to deal with terms such as jealousy and competition, where I don't even see that an 8-year-old is emotionally capable of or has that emotional vocabulary yet. So it starts really, 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 really young. I mean, 5, 6, 7, 8. Where did all of this start? Where is it? Is it really hardwired into us?
No, the competition is not hardwired. It's what we tell ourselves. You know, we tell ourselves stories and to make sense of the world. And the story we've told ourselves, the main story we've told ourselves, is that we have to compete, you know, that there's not enough out there, and so we better darn well get there first.
Survivalistic, I see.
And this story really comes primarily from science. You know, and it's not that way with every culture. That was the other interesting thing. You know, not every culture, and certainly many animals may have hierarchies, but they don't have this kind of competition to the death that we do. And if you look at what happens to us, you know, we're taught to value the individual and its distinctiveness. From the time we're born, look at the books we read, Fun with Dick and Jane. It's all about watching an individual get up to something and be special. And while I'm not against being special, my point is that, you know, we encourage kids from the time they're little to compete. We encourage them very hard in their school and their sports.
Sports, right.
We believe that, you know, we've had economic models that have encouraged us and said basically competition is necessary for survival. And so that's created a lot of the structures that we live by, but it's not universal. It's only a way of thinking. And the problem is the science shows us that this is not what we're hardwired to do. We're hardwired to share, care, and be fair. And every time we compete, we're weak. When we care and we share, we're strong. And that's why we're in such a mess now.
Well, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day. He used to be a principal of a high school. And he said that these days where there are a game that happens and every single kid gets a medal or a reward or something at the end of their game or their race or whatnot. He said that isn't necessarily a good thing because when we learn the difference between winning and losing, it helps us later on in life where we're wanting to win a battle over a disease or beat against all odds against an environmental factor or something that's going on in our personal life. You know, it doesn't give us that drive to be able to push through adversity.
That's the theory.
Okay.
I mean, not all societies do this. I mean, if you look at the way Japanese people are brought up, they're brought up very much to value the relationship. You know, a little child reads a book and it says, "Big brother and little brother are sitting together. Big brother loves little brother. Little brother loves big brother." They're taught about the relationship being the essential element, not the individual. There's nothing wrong with competing on the sports field, absolutely. It's just that we've created it as more or less the motto of our lives so that, you know, we see our neighbor, he's driving a Mercedes, we've only got a Ford, this kills us. You know, we have competition in our relationships now, and it spills over into having to be right all the time, having to be all about me. And because of that, we end up becoming very polarized. It's all about me. When a change of perspective of looking at the space between, looking at the relationship as number one, would give us that kind of aerial vision that we need right now to overcome the enormous polarization in our country. And the other thing is, if you look at biology and you look at human biology in particular, you see that we're hardwired to feel as good about giving and sharing as about having food and having sex. Now, nature wired us to want to connect, to have this fundamental will to connect, and it shows up in desperate needs to belong, needs to agree and imitate, a need to give and to care, and also a need to be fair. We're hardwired to be fair. And when we're not fair, when we have too much or we have too little, you know, we have certain firing in the brain that shows it's not fair, and we feel bad about it.
Yeah, I personally am the type of person that strives to connect. That's my lead value in life is connection. But I see it around me where it doesn't happen, and it goes into my heart wrong. I mean, it literally feels like a dagger going to my heart wrong. But that's not the case for everybody, and I want to explore this as far as we can because I just want to see where it's coming from. So the idea that nature is cohesive, I started questioning that as well. What about a herd of horses where the stallion becomes the dominant and then fights with the other male horses for the female?
Okay, well, he becomes dominant. He creates a hierarchy, and nature has a hierarchy. But if you notice, say, let's take chimps, you know, who are very dominant. You notice if a chimp has a fight with another chimp for dominance, they then have grooming mechanisms. They make up. They kiss and make up, in a sense. And there is that, and the other chimps crowd round and groom the loser, too. There's a sense of, okay, he's the top dog. He's going to run the show, but I'm also taken care of. And there's also, you know, a lot of it's not fair for chimps and other kinds of monkeys, too. So we're not talking about, you know, dominance and hierarchy. That's obvious in nature. What we're really talking about is mindless, senseless human competition. You know, we have this phrase, dog eat dog. But dogs never eat dogs. They eat squirrels. You know, they eat what they need if they're wild. They eat dog food if they're not. But, I mean, if they eat little animals that they need to survive, they don't eat each other. In the main, they cooperate with each other.
Well, right. And so when did this start with human beings? I mean, did it start 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Did it start at the beginning of caveman? When do you think it started in human nature?
Lisa, I think where we really defined modern society and created society really began with the scientific revolution, you know, 300 plus years ago, when Newton told us all that the world was made up of separate things that operate according to very regular laws in time and space. You know, we were suddenly ripped out of our world. I mean, before that, life was very much viewed in holism. You know, the world was looked at like some big intergalactic whole. And that, we now recognize, is much closer to the truth than the Newtonian view of everything being completely separate. You know, you see it now in science when they've tried to hunt for the smallest thing in the universe. You know, this is how science works. They look for the smallest things in the universe, and they figure they can describe the big stuff by finding the little stuff. And the more they look for the smallest subatomic particles, the thing out of which everything else in our universe derives, the more they see it's like a bunch of Russian dolls. You know, there's always something smaller inside. And when they finally, you know, get to that kind of level of matter, they find that there's nothing there. It's not a thing. It's just a relationship. It's just two particles sending energy back and forth, and it's impossible to separate one from the other. So that kind of element is mimicked through nature. You know, Newton was wrong. There aren't things. There are relationships. Einstein realized it. He said the field is the only reality. The relationship's the only reality, the totality. And we're now seeing that that was wrong, the whole idea of things and there being independent, definable, you know, separate entities is getting more and more disproved. But then the other aspect of it, the survival of the fittest, really came around with Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Darwin never said survival of the fittest. One of his friends suggested, coined the term, and he adopted it somewhat reluctantly, but basically was saying, well, this is a metaphor for life. But later on in his life, he really, really kind of backtracked a lot and said, no, nature is a lot more cooperative than this. It's not just about the big top dog. And yet, that survival of the fittest, when Darwin wrote his stuff, the printing press had just really been created mass printing, and his ideas swept the globe, and they were used for a lot of things, including burgeoning capitalism. So, you know, our industrial revolution as well as our scientific revolution kind of defined us as it gave us a machine consciousness that defined us like machines.
I mean, I do feel that we have gotten it from many different sources, not just the frontier, I mean, not just science, but, I mean, look into that survival of the fittest. It does exist in nature. I mean, the mountain lion eats the cat, and then the cat eats the bunny, and then the bunny eats the, you know, there's definitely a chain of survival in nature. So, I mean, help me out with this one, because I'm wanting to understand this, because I know how I operate. Okay, so, and I also want to build this case, okay?
Okay, well, Lisa, it's right that the animal, one animal eats a smaller, you know, that there's a chain of being. No question about that, but that's not survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest is all about, you know, it's survival of the one that can outrun the weakest, basically.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what really happens in nature. You know, the weakest one gets eaten. You know, the second less weak survives. But, you know, we're not really talking about an animal's need to eat. That's not survival of the fittest. What we're talking about is the metaphor that's really been offered for how things mutate and also how we survive. And remember, survival of the fittest is used with everything. It's like our jokes now, or even he who dies with the most toys wins.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Everything is about, we've taken that into our cultural lives. We said everything's all about survival of the fittest. So, yes, it's true. Nature needs to eat. Nature eats in a chain of being. And, you know, we all know this. It's indisputable. What is disputable, though, is do things change by themselves just because, you know, what Darwin had initially said is that things mutate randomly and that the fittest stuff survives. But the newest evidence shows something very different. They show a bond with our environment so that we are developing in response to our environment, and it's a two-way flow. In fact, it's an outside-in flow. So it's not about survival of the fittest. It's about cooperation with our environment. I'll give you an example.
Yeah, I was just going to ask for that. Okay, great.
Okay, some really weird stuff. Some bacteria got put into lactose, and this bacteria were lactose resistant. You know, they could not digest milk, basically. And what happened, or lactose intolerant, what happened then was really strange because the scientists assumed the bacteria would die. But that's not what happened at all. The bacteria started hypermutating, and the gene for lactose digestion, where, you know, the gene that the bacteria had couldn't digest, the bacteria suddenly started mutating to get changes and subtle changes in that gene, and it kept changing until it created a gene that could tolerate lactose and digest lactose. And the bacteria, believe it or not, snipped out the old gene and put in this new version. And this was, you know, this was published in one of the major scientific journals and caused an absolute uproar. And everybody was trying to disprove it, but it was, you know, demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now, it's just been done with bacteria, but there's been huge numbers of evidence of studies with humans showing that our environment alters the expression of our genes. You know, we are getting created all the time from outside in. So what this suggests is not survival of the fittest in order to evolve. This suggests cooperation with our environment in order to evolve.
Well, it has been proven, I mean, in the field of epigenetics, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that our environment, our perception of our environment physically changes or turns on, activates various genes. And there's all sorts of studies showing that molecular connection between a belief and how it can turn on an actual gene. But in this case, that's exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about that bond there between things, between a belief and a gene, between a cell and its environment, or between human beings and other human beings in this case, right?
Yeah, so that we're, in a sense, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to say, this is where I end and the rest of the world begins. Because if I'm changed by my diet, and I don't mean just I grow, but I'm changed, my genes turn on or off according to what I eat, what I drink, the relationships I have, the sum total of how I live my life, then you're talking about a bond. You're talking about a connection that gets a little messy, trying to say, well, this alone is me. So we are connected with that, and we are cooperating with it, and it is cooperating with us. It's a two-way flow. In particular, it's outside in.
So if you're saying if there's a connection between a belief that can turn on a gene, if there's a connection between an environment or a diet that can change a body, or a relationship that can change a body, if these types of connections exist, then let's pay attention to that which is the connection. Not the two things, but the space between those two things and what that exactly is. And I love the way that this is the big picture here, and is looking at why there is a banking crisis, a debt crisis, an energy crisis, an ecological crisis, all of this, as Lynn McTaggart is saying in her book, The Bond, is derived from this competitive impulse, destroy, 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 destroy. But if you look at nature, nature is full of creation, destruction, creation, destruction, creation, destruction, right?
Yeah, and nature has a drive to wholeness. You know, we've operated under the assumption that nature has a need for domination. And that's, you know, that's been true with, you know, our discussions, many discussions in a variety of disciplines. But the evidence shows in just about every scientific discipline coming out that nature has a drive to wholeness, and nature has designed life only in relationship. And until we start looking at that and valuing this, we will be in crisis. And, you know, we are in crisis now because we're living a lie, essentially. You know, when we compete, we're weak. You know, it comes down to when we connect, when we unite, we're strong and we thrive.
Well, the United States has been that strong factor, and it's been viewed like that for so long. And that type of perception is changing now, where it's not necessarily, well, there's a struggle for the United States now to remain that, quote, superpower, but it has been inbred in us as Americans.
Well, you know why? It's real simple. We're not uniting anymore. We are terrible right now. We are the most polarized and unfair in our history. We have huge polarization in political opinion.
True.
That refuses to look across the aisle. And we also have, we are the unfairest economically we've ever been. You know, we've got half the world's billionaires. One in 39 people is a millionaire in America, and 39 million people are below the poverty line. And one of the other things that I found really interesting in my book was through studies of epidemiologists, people who look at big populations and what happens. And there have been big studies of all the major Western countries, from Japan to Europe to the U.S., and they have found, without a shadow of a doubt, that the more unfair any society, the more there's this enormous disparity, the more there is lack of opportunity on the bottom and unfairness at the top, where there's over-control of money, the more things are bad for both sides, rich and poor, the more that, you know, everybody suffers in every possible social indicator, from education to health care to violence, et cetera. And if you look at the United States on these graphs, you want to weep. It's on the absolute bottom.
Well, you can tell that within a relationship. If the two couples, people in a relationship are polarized, it's bad for both people. If they're in a company and the top of the company is polarized from the employees, it's a bad situation. Anywhere you look, if there's a parent and the parent and the child are polarized, they're completely opposite in their, and there's no meeting of the minds there, it's bad for both people. Both people are in pain. So that could actually, you could chunk that all the way up to the United States and the globe, or you could chunk it all the way down to our home.
It's... Absolutely. And if we're forgetting now, America's motto is out of many one, e pluribus unum, you know, and we don't have that now. We have a government that can't even talk to each other. It's too busy throwing stones at each other all the time to really get anything done. And, you know, that's why we're suffering. That's why we're not, you know, that's why we are losing our status, because we can't, you know, we can't clean it. We need to clean up our own backyard. We need to start uniting as a country with a common goal.
And that's why
China is so strong. It is absolutely uniting for a common goal.
I mean,
and that's what America needs to do now.
And we could go in so many different directions with this. I have so many questions. But, you know, do you think that this could have something to do with why we're having natural disasters? That's a big ambiguous question. And I'm not going to have you answer that, by the way.
I could, Lisa. I could.
Oh, you could?
The answer is yes, because we're out there, you know, pushing our economic model at all costs, you know, and that's all about industrial and big corporations trying to make profits at all costs, trying to be first at all costs, and regardless of its effect on the environment. And that's causing major impact and major changes in our, you know, in our climate, which is causing all kinds of things. So I can't necessarily prove it had to do with,
right,
you know, the Japanese earthquake and tsunami.
Right.
But there certainly are a lot of things that are changing for the worse, you know, because of this relentless need to compete.
Okay, so here's my other big, you know, blaring question here. Do you sometimes, Lynn, do you sometimes feel that you are preaching to the choir? And how does this information fall on the masses?
Okay, well, everybody I've talked to so far starts nodding their heads. It's like we know this in our hearts. Because I say out of the bat, am I talking about socialism? Absolutely not. And I have a reasonable qualification to talk about that because I live in the UK, which has had socialist policies that I observed, and I observed their weaknesses. I am not talking about across-the-board sameness. I'm not talking about not being excellent. What I'm talking about is not being cutthroat competitive, not elbowing out the other person, not looking at relationships in terms of I and what I can get out of it, not looking at everything in your life as a race to the finish line, but starting to look at the space in between and the connection as being paramount. And if we do, and if we look back at why we've survived as a species, we'll see it had to do with cooperation and nothing to do with competition.
Interesting. And you have this perspective of traveling, you know, living in the UK and traveling all over the world and seeing things in so many different ways that you're a great person to talk to about this. And I can see how this concept would slowly but surely start to change, slightly shift perceptions of individuals as you travel along and spread the message from this book to people, and how it might potentially start to make a dent in people's thinking. So we're going to actually take a quick break, Lynn, and we're going to come back to continue this conversation about the bond, that space between us, and what that holds for all of us. We'll be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to The Aware Show. Welcome back to The Aware Show. This is Lisa Garr. Isn't it cool to have a whole conscious conversation in the middle of the afternoon? And it's just a great space, isn't it? Michael Beckwith and us and Nita Valens and all the great people on this radio station. Such a cool spot. Such a cool spot. And also in the middle of the night are wonderful people in the middle of the night. It's just a great spot. Anyway, I am talking with Lynn McTaggart, who is on the cutting edge of frontier science. That's your new tagline, Lynn. I love that. Frontier science. I've always looked for a word for it, but it's just so interesting to be in this time where old science is being cracked open by new consciousness science and the newly emerging science that's coming out now. And all of the studies that are being funded around these new sciences is just fascinating to me. Isn't it an exciting time for you to be writing about all of this as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I realized that when I wrote The Field, you know, that we were on a brink of this enormous revolution in our understanding. But even back with The Field, I kept asking to myself, okay, so how do we live this? You know, and I think it is time to live the new science. And that was really the purpose for writing The Bond. It was basically saying, you know, the science really tells us that we have to live in a different way. So how? What's really important? And right. That was really what I ultimately tried to address in the book.
So what we're talking about is Lynn's new book called The Bond, Connecting Through the Space Between Us. Basically, we're talking about that space in between us, the thing that connects all of us, those teeny-weeny particles in the space between you and me, between you and another person, between anything. And I love the impetus that you had behind this whole book, which is why were we made to connect or compete. So knowing all that you know now, Lynn, and knowing that you have, that there is a space between us and that it is actually a thing and that it is about connection, that we are hardwired for this compassionate response towards each other, what do you do when you get into a situation like you did with your daughter now, or if that were to come up again, where your daughter got edged out by somebody or competition entered into your life? I mean, there's a lot of competition in the field of science as well.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting looking at one daughter, too, who is very good at sport. You know, that is a competitive thing. She has a sports scholarship. So how do
Wow.
we deal with this? Well, you know, not by telling her not to play well,
right.
but also making her aware that she's part of a team. And that she shouldn't, you know, it's not about elbowing herself into the place, the best position. It's about playing well as a team and also respecting her teammates and playing, you know, not hogging the ball and all of that. And so I make a big point of that, and I make a point of integrity, of making sure that she's, you know, she is working together and working as a group. And I think that's really my message is, how to do that, how to shift your perception so it's not just about me, it's about us, and how you can bring that into your life by seeing much more holistically, that there's ways and techniques I talk about in the bond of, you know, seeing wider, seeing something besides just your own little path and your own place in the world.
Well, especially when it comes
to connection.
When it comes to our kids, we're, you know, I mean, I have that whole mama lion perspective sometimes too. If someone's hurting my daughter, I get defensive about it. And it's for what you're talking about here. You have a, you know, the same situation, or if anybody else who has kids has that same instinct to rise to the occasion. If somebody is hurting someone you love,
Yes. Then
you know, if that's, talk about human instinct. I'm not talking about fighting.
I was furious at what happened. What was important to me was not trying to, you know, I talked to the mother. In my book, I talk about how, you know, the mother, I tried to bring this up with the mother, and she turned to me and shrugged her shoulders and said, well, that's life.
Right.
Her daughter had lied to take over the position given to my daughter.
Uh-huh.
And the worst thing of it was, her daughter was my daughter's best friend.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, that's a heavy one.
But
so
she's
what,
right.
What was most important for me, I thought, was to really get my daughter to understand a few things. You know, and to see that this wasn't good behavior, this wasn't appropriate, this isn't what life's all about, and, you know, this is not necessarily a good friend. So
what
was really important is really her lesson out of the situation.
Yeah.
There wasn't really much I could do about it with the other girl and her mother. That was their choice.
But what the mother said is that's life is a true statement. That is the way that life is right now. And what you're trying to do here is change that perception. And there are, of course, people that have changed that perception in their life, which I think is fantastic. And you're giving it more of a platform to be able to change that perception.
Well, I'm saying that there are easy ways of doing this, to start looking in wholeness, that we are hardwired to, you know, we experience it in every way. You know, we need belonging before anything else. And even our weird competition is a strange kind of belonging because, you know, one of the things that shocked me was the second highest suicide rates occur in the richest neighborhoods of America. That just shocked me. And the reason it is it because those people who make a little bit less than somebody else.
Mm.
So it's the big keep up with the Joneses thing. In fact, you know, there was a stark statistic. For every 10,000 or every 10% less you make from your neighbors, your suicide risk goes up 7.5%.
Wow.
So I was kind of blown away by this, you
yeah.
know. But what it is really a thwarted need to belong. We need to be, you know, we need to belong together. We need to know that we're just part of the group all the time. And that becomes the most important thing for us. And it's probably the biggest protector. You know, there, so many studies show that belonging to a group, even having a bad relationship, is more health protective than no relationship. So it's so important to us. It's so needy.
Really?
You know, we so need it. But the problem is, because we defined ourselves so much as individuals and separate, it's hard for us to see past our own perspectives. This is why we are so polarized. And so one of the things I look at the bond is, how do you see the whole? How do you get an aerial perspective? And there's a number of really good techniques that can stoke that.
Okay, good. And let's talk about some of those. How do we get to that?
Well, the first thing is, I mean, there are techniques like mindfulness meditation, which just practicing that, which is, you know, being aware of the present moment. Just say concentrating on your cornflakes in the morning. Let's say you're eating your cornflakes. And, you know, most of us are eating our cornflakes thinking of something else, you know, what we're about to do for the day. But suppose you focus just on those cornflakes with your five senses. Studies have shown that if you do that kind of thing, you're just aware, you smell, you taste, you feel, you just focus on your five senses at the present moment. Several times during the day, you start just seeing wider. Now, that's interesting about your cornflakes, but that's not really the purpose for doing stuff like that. What ends up happening is, as you start to see wider, as you start to see better detail in your life, as you begin to see the whole and stop being so blind to it, as we all are, you also start seeing other people's points of view. You know, there have been many examples of this, where people can exist together with paradoxes. For instance, a friend of mine, Mark Gerson, works in crisis areas, like, you know, the occupied area in Palestine. And he works with both Israelis and with the Palestinians. And he asked them, how can you guys work together so effectively? And they said, we have learned to live with paradox. And he said, what do you mean? And he said, okay, well, let's give an example. Let's both write a paragraph, me, Palestinian, and one Israeli, about the birth of Israel. So they did. And the Palestinians wrote the disaster. And they wrote all about how the Palestinian homeland had been, you know, taken over and invaded, and they were left homeless. And then the Israeli wrote historic, you know, occasion for the establishment of Israel. And they wrote about how, you know, the Jews had finally received their historic right to their homeland, and that the UN had sanctioned it, but that they'd been beleaguered by all sides. Well, the real point Gerson had to make about all of this is that both sides were absolutely right. You know, that the truth is really about both sides, and the real way of relating is to understand about how to relate in the space between, and how you can learn to change your perspective and your vision to see both sides and to honor both sides so that you find that kind of place in between.
And to find what's common between the two, because maybe they have something in common that is love, or that is parenting or relatedness or something like that, that they do have in common, and to focus more on that.
Yes, and you put the relationship before being right. Mm. I mean, that's one of our problems of separation and individualism, too. It's ended up creating that in our relationships, because when we look for relationships, we just look for people just like us. That's, you know, what makes up our friends. In a sense, we're looking for I in every person we meet. And so we have a hard time tolerating any kind of difference as a result. And we find it, you know, very contentious to try to put ourselves in service to the relationship, because we're so busy trying to be right. But there's a guy in your area of the woods, Orland Bishop, who is working in Watts to try to get rival gang members to speak with each other. I mean, this seems like a fool's errand, right? But he's doing so by teaching them to talk truthfully and deeply to each other, and to be respectful of the relationship, and basically to say one thing to themselves: what do I have to be to give this person what he needs in order to be all that he can be? You know, when you put yourself in service to the relationship, when you stop just looking about how I can be right and winning a debate and being top dog, you put yourself into that space in between, and then you can see difference, and it's okay. It doesn't matter.
There is so much evidence around all of this, and I'm so glad you put it all in one book. I mean, Howard Martin, you know, from HeartMath, and there's a whole concept that he says that the heart sends more information to the brain rather than the opposite. So, in fact, that we are led by our hearts or our emotions more than we are by our mental function. And that makes a lot of sense, because it gets into this: how do we feel when we're connected versus how do we feel when we're separate? And there's, I mean, that's all you need to do is look at that feeling when you're separated from somebody. If it's a negative separation, it doesn't feel good. Or if you want to be with someone and you're separated, it doesn't feel good. So there's, you know, you can basically listen to your own instinct and look inside your own self and see how connection feels so much better. And of course, it creates a cascade of endorphin release and great hormones that release and neurotransmitters that release that all make you feel good. And of course, strengthen and build the immune system, right?
Well, absolutely. And the other thing that's so interesting, Lisa, is it allows you to step across the aisle. You know, when you start taking this position that you're going to be in service to this relationship, you can tolerate difference with much greater ability. And you still find the connection, because we're connecting automatically no matter what. I mean, the evidence on mirror neurons shows that when I see you do an action or have an emotion, the exact same neurons fire in me as if I were having that emotion or I was carrying out that action. So nature has designed us to understand the world by, in a sense, merging with it. So my thoughts are always a complicated mix of mine and yours. So we're always having that merging with everybody, no matter how disagreeable the person is. But if we learn the techniques of getting to the space in between, and when we learn to just change that perspective from me to us, then we can tolerate difference. So I show you an example of that in two groups on opposite side of one of the most contentious issues in America, abortion. There was a pro-life group and a pro-choice group in Boston that decided that they had to come together to talk when a bunch of people got murdered in a Planned Parenthood there. So they met in secret for a couple of years. And during this time, they just shared deeply with each other. Didn't try to persuade, didn't try to debate. They just shared deeply why they believed what they believed. And over time, they started to watch each other's backs. So when there were more threats to other abortion clinics, the pro-life people would tip off the pro-choice people. And they just and they started doing this in return, too. So then at the end of a couple of years, they held a press conference. And one of the reporters said to them, okay, so who won the debate? And they said, well, no one, because we both feel much more entrenched in our positions, having talked about them so much. We really believe much more what we believe. And so they said, well, then it must have been a failure. And both sides said, oh, no. We go out together. We watch each other's children. We party together. We love each other. And that's the whole point. You know, you step into the space between. You learn how to dialogue without having a debate where you just share and you value the relationship instead of being right. And suddenly you find not only common ground, you find connection.
And that, I mean, that's a great example of when the reporter said who won the debate, because as we're having this conversation and the people that are listening to this conversation are agreeing with us or not agreeing with us, but listening to this conversation about the connection, there will still be people who are not in this conversation, who do not have this sense of connection, that will come at you with the competition, with the rage, with the anger. Some of the listeners are calling in saying, what about racial debates? What about working environments and so forth? So there are, you know, people out there who will not be able to involve themselves in this place. So how do you do that when you're the only one having the conversation?
Okay, well, how about, let's answer, how about racial debates? How about the office? And I'll answer that with another kind of example. How do you bring a bunch of disparate and competitive people together? And I'll tell you it by way of a fantastic study that was done in the 50s. It was called the Robbers Cave Experiment, and it was carried out by the person who invented social psychology. He sent a bunch of boys who were 12 years old to a camp called Robbers Cave, and they selected the boys, and they put them in two buses, and they told each bus full of boys that they should create their own group. They should give it a name, they should give it a flag, and that they were going to compete with the other boys. And they had separate living quarters, so they created the Rattlers, one group, and the Eagles. And they came together with these highly competitive games. All the camp counselors were actually psychologists in disguise. After a while, they didn't have to stoke any kind of competition. These very competitive games resulted in the kids basically killing each other. They ripped up their flags. They stole the prizes. They started beating each other up. And no amount of just getting them together would ease this situation. So the camp counselors came up with another idea that the guy, Mustafa, a sheriff who ran it, wanted to test. He created a bunch of crises in the camp that could only be solved with the collective effort of everybody, all the boys. For instance, they cut off the water supply by putting a big boulder in the water tank, and the boys had to work together to lift the boulder, and so on and so forth. There were a bunch of these. And all of a sudden, relations started to thaw. The boys started sitting together. They started relating to each other. They started putting their arms around each other, and they voted unanimously by the end of the camp to ride in the same bus and bought each other's ice creams. They were absolutely bonded. And the reason was what's called a superordinate goal, which means it's a goal that we can only achieve by all working together. No matter what we believe, we all work together for that bigger common goal. And whatever our difference falls apart, falls away. The reason it does is very simple, scientifically. When we do things together, when we fire together, we wire together as people. They show that when people are working on something together, like, say, jazz musicians, all playing the same music, your brains start working in tandem. We've
right.
also seen studies with Oxford rowers in England where, you know, the rowers, when they found that when you row in a group, your pain threshold rises much higher than it is when you row separately.
Right, right.
So it's like barn building, essentially. So one of my suggestions I have in the book is you can take that whole idea of superordinate goals and apply it everywhere. You can apply it to your work. You can apply it to your neighborhood.
Well, wait, I have a question.
You can apply it to the country.
It seems, though, that we do come together out of crisis. I remember back in 9/11, and it was the last time I ever saw my neighbors. It was the first time, actually. So it was, you know, one of those situations where if does it take a crisis in order to be able to come together like this and to create that bond? Obviously, hopefully the answer is no, and then how do we do it without the crisis?
Okay, well, let's say you want to get something done in your neighborhood, like Tailhold, Oklahoma did. They couldn't get federal funding for a pipeline. They had barely drinking water. This is a little forgotten neighborhood of Oklahoma. So the residents decided they would build it themselves, and the men got together, and they started getting their pickaxes and their shovels and starting to build it together. The women started cooking food for them, and at the end of it, they had their drinking water, but they had something more. They had a unified and solid community, and it started becoming infectious. They started working together for all sorts of things. So you can do it that way. Well, you can do it in business. Dave Barnum created Hot Dog on a Stick in Santa Monica, you know, near you all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it became a very successful franchise. Before he died, he turned it over to all of its employees. So the employees own Hot Dog on a Stick as a franchise. It's the only fast food franchise owned by the employees. And they have the lowest turnover of any franchise in the country.
Hmm.
You know, John Lewis, a department store in the UK, has a partnership. It's a department store chain, but the employees all own the business instead of having outside stockholders. And every year, at the end of the year, when there are profits, they're redistributed to all of the employees. So you all get 15% of your salary. So, of course, there's differentials in salaries. The head guy makes more than the person who stacks the shelves. But everybody is a part of reaping the rewards. And during the, you know, 2008 recession and the beginning of the recession, John Lewis has done better than other companies because, as some of the employees say, it was hard, but we all pulled together. And that's the kind of mentality that you can kind of take into any kind of situation, whether you create some sort of activism in your neighborhood, whether you want to bring this to the office. It brings people together. It doesn't take a crisis. It just takes a project.
So is that how Starbucks operates? Because I know that they have their partners as employees. I've always seen that out. We're looking for partners who want to be a part of our team type of thing.
Well, if it's a partnership, yes. I mean, then the employees, so it doesn't have outside stockholders. It means the employees are all own it together. And that means that, you know, that profits are redistributed. It gives people a sense of making their work a superordinate goal.
Right.
But as I say, you can use this for just about anything. It's the idea of you can create it even if your business is, you know, it's got shareholders. The idea of everybody coming together for a bigger goal. When you start doing that, the difference, you know, you're all working together. And this is what America needs. I mean, we need it not only in our relationships. We need it in our neighborhoods because we are now getting to the point where the fastest growing neighborhoods are gated communities because all that we want to do is be with another bunch of people just like us. And there have been some studies showing we'd rather not go out than be with people who are ethnically diverse. Well, obviously, once again, out of many one, this is what America was. All you need to do is start creating these kinds of superordinate goals and differences fall away. You know, a guy called Don Beck is doing this in the Middle East. He brings both sides together and says, let's build the Hong Kong of the Middle East. there's a superordinate goal. Let's ignore what came in the past. Let's do something pragmatic and work together. Well, and by doing that, those differences fall away. You walk into the space between.
And it's shown throughout science. I mean, Greg Braden's doing the great, a lot of those studies are being done about with the random number generators and the human consciousness field and showing the spikes that happen when there's a major event that happens in our universe or in our world and how it spikes those random number generators and makes a big difference. And it just does validate the connection between human beings and the fact that there is one. And where it seems, and that we are fed so much information about separatism and about competition and differences, that it really is a nice, refreshing conversation. And I really appreciate that you wrote this book. Have you noticed that there have been, even though it's relatively new, people starting their own bond groups or neighborhood groups or any types of movements that have happened as a reaction to the book?
I had a meeting yesterday. I've been just starting to speak about the book. It's only a week old. And yesterday I've had people crying, standing up, absolutely saying, I'm going to do this. You've changed my mind. I'm going back and I'm doing this. Somebody told me yesterday that they were starting to work on, informed type of investing. Other people have said they wanted to create community compassionate projects. People are starting to make, we have people doing YouTube videos. I have a section of YouTube, The Bond Book, it's called. That's how you get in.
Oh, great.
And I'm inviting everybody to speak into a camera and say, I know there's a better way, whether to do business, relationships, or whatever, to talk about, how you think we should do things different with the principles of the bond. Because I think this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to get the dialogue going. I wanted for people to understand it doesn't take a lot. You know, we keep thinking it's going to take our government to fix things, and we keep waiting for them to start talking to each other, or we need to change presidents or keep this president.
No, we
want the big guys to do it. And what my real message is it doesn't take that. I mean, I was fascinated to see in my research that they found that, we're so affected by networks of people. Our actions not only affect our friends, they affect our friends' friends' friends. It just goes down a network of social groups. And what they found is, one act of kindness or generosity goes about three or four stages down a network. So if I'm kind to you, it not only affects you, but it affects your friends, your friends' friends, your friends' friends' friends.
And I'd love you, if you guys are listening and you have ideas on how to do things differently, how to create this bond, give us a call, 818-985-5735. Tell Gina, the producer here, just throw her a couple of ideas, of concepts, and I'll tell them on the air here if you can, because we just have a couple of minutes here. But I want to get that, and maybe I can have you on the teleseminar series so that we can really get those people to write that stuff in and log it and read it and so forth. I think that'd be great, because then you can see the effect of the change that is happening. And but if people are listening right now, give us a call, 818-985-KPFK. I have a few minutes left where I can read some of the things that you think you can do differently to create the bond, where this conversation just now changed your mind in some way with something that was separated in your life, something that was that didn't have a connection, that had adversity to it, and how you think by listening to Lynn McTaggart talking about the bond, the connection between us, and how much more powerful that is, and how many more things get resolved in that space, and really how much it contributes to how we're really hardwired, which is about cohesiveness, and seeing how this conversation changed something that happened in your life today, if you're going to do something in the future about it, if it's a relationship, if it's a bad divorce or something that was leading towards a divorce, find the connection that was between you and see if you can find that common ground to at least make things a little bit gentler through the process or a little bit nicer through the process. Starting reading groups, discussion groups, whatever it is that you want to do, I just want to know how this has affected your life. So Gina's going to take your calls real quick, but we are running out of time. Again, the name is The Bond by Lynn McTaggart. And Lynn, I'll email you some of these things that are coming through, okay?
Wonderful. I want to just emphasize, too, that people don't have to do big things. There was a woman who at one company who left change in a Coke machine every day. And it so freaked out people in the company, they kept trying to find out who it was, that it changed all of the conversation. She then went up to another floor and started leaving donuts and just said, you know, these have been left for you, pay it forward. It totally changed the culture, the selfish culture
of
that company.
One little act like that. Very, very cool. Well, some people are saying meet at regular times as a group, 8 p.m. on Thursdays. Just find a regular time to meet. Start reading groups and discussions. Watch the movie Meet John Doe, maybe about this. There's a lot of good stuff coming in. Well, I am out of time here, but I think that you have been just thank you so much because you're obviously creating change. The phone lines are ringing here, so I'll get these comments to you and put them up as things that people can do to make change, and I really appreciate it. So this is an action conversation, and thanks for starting it off. I appreciate it, Lynn.
Thank you very much. It's always great to be with you, Lisa.
You too. And if people want to find out more about the book or you can see it on YouTube, what was that again, the Bond book?
It's the Bond book for YouTube, but also they can check my website, which is www.thebond.net.
TheBond.net, TheBond.net. Smile, it's contagious. That's a great one as well. All right, thank you so much, Lynn, and thank you all very much for listening and for calling in. And I encourage you, until next time, to stay aware.